You're listening to Sports Connections with David Smale, the show that brings you a fun and intimate look into connections throughout sports. Now here's your host, David Smale.
If you're one of the 100 million or so people who watched the Super Bowl in Tampa last night, you saw once again the handiwork of George Toma, the sod father, the Marquis de Sade, the nitty-gritty dirt man. You have to be pretty special to have so many great nicknames, and Toma certainly is special. He not only was the head groundskeeper for Super Bowl 55, he was also the head groundskeeper last year, Super Bowl 54, which took place on his 91st birthday, and he saw his beloved Kansas City Chiefs defeat the San Francisco 49ers. Watching his favorite team win the Super Bowl had actually happened before, as he was also the head groundskeeper for Super Bowl IV in 1970 when the Chiefs defeated the Minnesota Vikings. In fact, he was the head groundskeeper for Super Bowl I, then known as the first AFL-NFL championship game when the Chiefs played the Green Bay Packers, and he's been the head groundskeeper for every other Super Bowl in history. Came to Kansas City in 1957 to resuscitate a Major League Baseball field with more gravel than grass, and that grass was really crabgrass and clover. Before heading to Kansas City to check out the conditions, he called his mentor, who said, "George, don't go to Kansas City. I've been going there once or twice a month trying to straighten that place out." Thomas still took the job, and he says, "because if I screwed up, nobody would notice." Didn't take long for him to turn the field at Municipal Stadium into an oasis, receiving compliments from players throughout the American League. And when the Dallas Texans franchise of the old AFL moved to Kansas City in 1963, Thomas' work increased as he was responsible for maintaining the field for professional football and baseball. Following the announcement of the merger of the AFL and the NFL, NFL Commissioner Pete Rozelle came to Kansas City, famously told Chiefs owner Lamar Hunt, "Your groundskeeper is amazing." That led to Toma being selected to prepare the field for the first Super Bowl and every other Super Bowl since. He joins us today for an interview recorded before he headed to Tampa for the Super Bowl in mid-January, because we're not going to keep him away from the Super Bowl. George, welcome to Sports Connections.
Well, it's an honor and pleasure to be with you. It's an honor and pleasure as we're speaking with an honest and then some man.
We'll get to and then some here in just a little bit. What was it like for you to prepare the field last year for Super Bowl 54 for your Chiefs after not seeing them in a Super Bowl for 50 years?
Well, actually, it was great because I would like to see one of the end zones again, like I painted back in 1963, gold background with red letters, and then had the same end zone for Super Bowl I and the same end zone for Super Bowl IV. And we didn't see it for a while.
Yeah.
But most of all, I was pulling for the Chiefs because of Lamar Hunt. I wanted the Chiefs to win this game for Lamar Hunt. And before the game, I was talking with Commissioner Goodell, and we were talking, and I says, "Commissioner, I'm pulling for the Chiefs today because of Lamar Hunt. I want them to win for Lamar Hunt and also for the fans of Kansas City." He said, "George, you can't do that." He says, "you work for the league pays you, you got to be neutral." So I was neutral, and the Chiefs came back and won the game.
Yeah, I don't believe that you were neutral. You might have been neutral outwardly, but inside you were rooting like crazy for the Chiefs, weren't you?
Well, I was standing near the Chiefs end zone, near the goalpost, and the crew wouldn't let me move because they says I was bringing good luck to the Chiefs in the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
So I had to stay right by the goalpost.
Okay. Now, you've been there, as we talked about, for all 55 Super Bowls. What keeps bringing you back?
Well, actually, it's something I love to do. Plus the fact that we have a family, and the family of a groundkeepers. And first Super Bowl, I only had myself and four people from the Los Angeles Coliseum crew. And we got the job done. Our equipment only fit in a trunk 3 feet by 4 feet. Today, now we have one or two tractor trailer fulls of equipment.
Yeah.
And then working with the crew now, we have some 30 people, because we only don't not only have the game field, but we have 4 practice fields, and we have the NFL experience with 6 fields to paint lines and logos on them, plus the halftime show rehearsals. And say about a week or two after the Super Bowl, I get a nice letter from Commissioner Goodell thanking me for doing the job and how good the field was and so forth, and says at the end, see you next year.
Yeah. So you're pressured into it.
During the season off between Super Bowls during the year, I get a note now and then from Commissioner Goodell to see how things are going and thanking me for all I do for the league.
What date do you head to the Super Bowl? About 2 weeks ahead or a little more than that? How long do you have to be down there?
Actually, it'd be almost a month.
Wow.
Because we have practice fields to get ready. Sometimes it's 6 months if we have to go in there and build 4 practice fields or 2 practice fields. And when we go in, we have a crew as a family, and like our director of the playing field is Ed Mangan, who I got the job with the Atlanta Braves years back, and then got him the job as the director of the field, and who gets the housing and all that, the crew's lined up. And he's excellent. He's been with me now for 35 years.
Wow.
And then we have a local boy Randy Baker from Belton High School. He's a groundkeeper at Belton High School. This year will be his 22nd Super Bowl.
Wow.
And last year, he was very important. I made sure that he painted the Chiefs end zone, and a very good man from Belton High School.
Other than watching the Chiefs play in the Super Bowl 3 times, and as we're recording this, we're confident that we'll be talking about a 4th time, but other than watching the Chiefs play in the Super Bowl, what are some of the highlights for you of being at the Super Bowl and being part of that experience?
Well, actually, being at the Super Bowl, you meet a lot of people and a lot of coaches. And you remember, like, I can close my eyes yet and see Otis Taylor running down the sideline for a touchdown right past me.
Uh-huh.
And meeting coaches like John Harbaugh at a Super Bowl came up to me and gave me a hug. And he says, George, this is from me. And he said, this hug's from my wife. And this hug's from my grandfather. And I said, why from your grandfather? He said, you let him cut the grass at the Super Bowl in Palo Alto at Stanford between the Dolphins and the 49ers.
Wow.
And then you have good relationships with Joe Gruden. And Weeb Eubank came to Kansas City and played a game, and on Saturday they had a workout. When he came to the field, he says to the team, you're not going on that field. That field's so beautiful. We're going to practice on the sidelines. So you meet a lot of good coaches, and Don Shula and I were close, and we're still close with a lot of coaches. And then I had to do some work up at the Patriots. The field was bad, and I had to resod the whole field within a week. And then Saturday night, I was at the hotel, and Coach McPherson was the coach for the Patriots that time. And he says, how about coming down and telling the ball players at 9 o'clock at night, it was, call me, come down, tell the players how the field will be and what to expect. And he says, tell them something about the and then some, you know, you're blocking the player, make sure you block and get that little extra, that end then some when you're running. So the Patriots were playing the Jets, and they were on the 2-yard line or goal line, 4 chances to push it in, and they couldn't push it in. And the next day they were saying, "Hey, Hen Gensom, how are you, Hen Gensom?" I said, "Yeah, I made the same speech to the Jets, and they listened. They had the Hen Gensom." But you have about or Jim Kelly, the quarterback for the Buffalo Bills, would always come down before the game and tell me a joke while he was working on the field, call me over. But you meet a lot of good people.
Last week, we posted an interview with a friend of mine who has worked on the team that coordinates the halftime show. And I'm not exactly sure what her role is as we record this now. Obviously, by the time it posts, I will. But my question for you is, how hard is it for you to watch your beautiful field be invaded by all the staging for the halftime show?
Well, a lot of times there's a lot of damage done, but they have to do the job. They have to practice to get that stage in and out in so many minutes. And we paint a practice field for them on the parking lot outside where they rehearse for a while. Mm-hmm. But for the last week or 10 days, they come in almost every day for 4 or 5 hours. So we have to fix that and do this and that, but they have to practice. And when the halftime show is over at the game, you're so proud of them. And like at the Super Bowl IV, they had 2 balloons go up with a Chiefs and a Viking.
Right.
They crashed into the end zone. Mm. And we had a Super Bowl in New Orleans. And then we had to hold the game up because the boat that they had, a Mississippi boat, river boat, couldn't get underneath the goalpost. So we had to hold the kick up to take the goalpost down to get the boat off. But you have things like that happen, you know, but it all comes out in the wash.
I want to talk about, I said in my introduction that you came to Kansas City to basically resuscitate a field that was mostly gravel and crabgrass. Talk about the difficulty in maintaining a field for Major League Baseball and a pro football team at the same time when those seasons overlapped. How hard was that to do?
Well, actually, I had a lot of experience when I was just say 12 years old to 16 years old into there. When I was 16 years old, I was the head groundkeeper for the Wilkes-Barre Barons, which was an Eastern League team, and were called, owned by the Cleveland Indians in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. That's the heart of the anthracite coal region. And we had baseball, and then we had high school football on the field, and then we had the Wilkes-Barre Bullets, which was a team in the Eastern Professional League. And then coming to Kansas City, it was a little tough in a way because the Philadelphia Athletics moved to Kansas City in 1955. Mm-hmm. So when they moved here, they never had a major league operation. And they hired the general manager was a AAA and the stadium manager was a AAA. So they hired a good golf course superintendent to be the groundkeeper, but they never gave him any help.
Yeah.
And then they had to let him go. And then they hired Eddie Dick from the Indianapolis Indians. Emil Brosser brought him in, but it still wasn't a major league operation. When the team went away, they laid everybody off but one man. Mm. So they bought a new tarp. They put the new tarp down, and then he didn't have enough men to take it off, so he cut it in half.
Oh.
So they fired him. But when I was there for tarp crew, we would have had Henry Wheat, who was a black man, and everybody knew Henry Wheat. He was an idol. He would go upstairs up to the ticket office and get $20 and then go down to 18 and Vine and get 10 winos and give them $2 a piece and bring them. That was our tarp crew to get the tarp off.
Yeah.
But it was a little tough because from 1957 until 1994, when I was with the Royals, I never had an assistant. I never had anybody work all year. So we depended on two men. One was a bum who rolled the rails, and he slept in the shed in center field. And the ball player brought him to me and gave him a job. And I had another one there. And then I had to depend on Lincoln High School and Central High School students to do the job. But we did the job. We had the Kansas City A's, the Kansas City Royals. Then we had the Kansas City Chiefs. We had the Kansas City Spurs, mm-hmm. who was a Major League Soccer team. We had the Beatles concert, Billy Graham. And we got the job done with all these two men and these kids. And the thing was that we had baseball, football, and soccer. And then they put up the Wolfpack stands. And that was a lot of footing and little damage. But we never resodded the field in all those years. In 10 years, we never resodded with all those activities. And they said we had the best playing field in baseball, the best in football. Pele said that was the second best field he played on. And the thing is, like, the Chiefs have an excellent playing field, an excellent crew. And for the last week there, they sod it down the center of the field. Well, what it cost them to sod down the center of the field, it would have taken us 30 years at Municipal Stadium to spend that much money to do it. But it was the Lord has helped me with this. I believe in the Lord, and I play every night to the Lord for thanking and to send these people to help me. And we got it done all the way from 57 to 94 at the Royals. I never had an assistant or anybody work all year, but these people got it done. And there's people outside the organization around the world. I never asked for anything, but they always came and gave us supplies and this. Sometimes it would amount to $1 million a year.
Wow.
Like Cash and Hilton Hayes from John Deere out of Texas gave us every year $700,000 worth of equipment, brand new every year. So people from Germany helped me, people from England helped me, and it was the Lord and all these young people from, say, started out at Lincoln and Central High School. They did the job and then some. And it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be here talking to you.
You've mentioned the phrase a few times already now, and then some. And I know that when you sign an autograph, you know, you wish somebody best wishes and then some. And it really speaks to the work ethic that you've had for your entire career. I mean, it's coming up on 75 years or maybe longer that you've been in this business, that you will do everything that's needed to get the job done and then some. And then you'll just go the extra mile. Talk about where that phrase came from and talk about where that work ethic came from.
Well, actually, the work ethic comes from my bringing up in the Anthracite Coal region. Everybody there was poor. I mean, the houses were close together, but everybody raised chickens. Everybody had ducks. They had grapevines. They had fruit trees. They had a garden. Some even had pigs and some had cows. And then it was all that extra work. But I just forget the gentleman's name. He wrote a letter to to Ewing Kaufman, telling me he comes to the games and never seen anybody work as hard as me and has the and then some. And it was this gentleman that inspired me about doing the and then some. the two, the job and a little extra.
And then talk about, I know you're a man of meticulous detail as well. You know, and we'll get to something that I connected with you on recently about, you know, the one blade of grass is out of place. You know, you have so much detail in you. Where does that come from? Is that from your upbringing as well?
Well, actually, when I was working, you know, I was young. When I was 10 years old, my father died. We went out for a walk and coming back, he fell right down in front of me and died from anthracillosis, which was black lung disease. Mm. And I was 10 years old. And in those days, you had to get a job because, you know, the family had a mother and a sister. And they were great. And my grandmother and uncles helped take care of me. And so I had to get a job, and I didn't want to work in the mines. When I tell them they were 8 years old in them days, and you're working in the mines at 8 years old, because the coal company owned the house, they owned the store, they owned everything.
Right.
And then these 8 year old boys were killed from rock slides. And not only that, but most of them were killed from being kicked by mules, because they were the ones that led the mules out of the mines with the coal cars. So I had to get a job. So I got a job on a vegetable farm when I was 10 years old, 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, 10 cents an hour. So when I was 11 years old, I got a job on a chicken farm, which was 50 cents a day and lunch. And the farmer treated and taught me a lot. Every Saturday, he would say, kill two chickens and take all the eggs and all the vegetables you can carry home. And he taught me a lot. And then when I was 12, our next door neighbor up the street was the head groundkeeper for the Wilkes-Barre Barons, Class A Eastern League Cleveland owned team. So I started to work with him, with another young boy, Jimmy Mazzillo. We were 12 years old. And then he treated me like a father. And then when I was 16 years old, Bill Beck owned the Cleveland Indians and made me the head groundkeeper when I was 16.
Wow.
And my neighbor, Stan Schechter, had training experience, a trainer, and he became the head trainer. So wow. I started at 16, and then 1950, I was drafted into the Army, went to Korea. Then when I came back from Korea, Wilkes-Barre didn't have a team. They moved to Reading, so Hank Greenberg told me, he was with Cleveland, that he's sending me to Reading, and I told him I'm not going. I says, my best friend is there, he's married and has two children, I'm not going to take his job. He said, then we'll send you to Sherbrooke, Canada, with a brand new stadium. I said, Canadian American. I said, okay. Then in that week, Wilkes-Barre got an expansion team from the Detroit Tigers. So I worked with them under Detroit Tigers in 54. And then in 55, they asked me to be their groundkeeper in Buffalo, New York, International League, AAA. Then they sold that. And we went to Charleston, West Virginia, to AAA League. And then in 57, John McHale, the general manager, president of the Tigers, called me and said, they just gave permission to Kansas City to talk to me. So go up the press box and call up Park Carroll, the general manager. So before I called Park Carroll, I called Emil Bosser, and he told me to stay out of there. But what happened there, when they moved from Philadelphia, they operated a minor league, and then it took them. I was never had an assistant or anybody all work here since I left, like gave the job up at 1994. But I have to take my hat off and give a lot of credit to Dan Glass and Dave Glass and to the man Dayton Moore.
Mm-hmm.
Dayton Moore and Dan Glass and David Glass, they turned Kansas City around of having to bring it to make it a major league groundkeeper operation. And I have to say again, thank David Glass and Dan Glass and especially Dayton Moore for doing that. It took him 55 years from 1955 when they moved to from Philadelphia until Dayton Moore took over to make Kansas City. And Trevor Vance now has three assistants all year. And Trevor worked with me, and he was a very important part of my Super Bowl crew.
Mm-hmm.
And he does an outstanding and then some job. My hat off is to everyone over there.
You mentioned a couple of the people that you owe a lot to and that you've been impressed with. There have been some interesting people, some interesting characters in your career as well. And you and I've talked before about some of them. I'd like to ask you about a few of them. I want to start with Charlie Finley. And you surprised me when we talked a couple of months ago about your fondness for Charlie Finley. Most people in Kansas City don't think too highly of him, but you're in the minority. You think very highly of Charlie Finley.
Well, actually, I'm been in this game 79 years. And Charlie Finley is the greatest owner I ever worked for.
Hmm.
He took care of the little guy. When he came to Kansas City, one of the first things he did was double my salary.
Wow.
And then he took care of the young high school students at Lincoln and Central High School. And they were outstanding. They would drag that infield in 28 seconds and it'd be like a pool table. Today, I see major league teams, their infields are like washboards. And they did a tremendous job. And even the Royals took us up to, in 1970, took us up to Milwaukee for a three-game series to race the Milwaukee ground crew. They had a good ground crew. And Dave Miller was the head up there, and he's now the head groundkeeper about to retire from the Red Sox. And we did it in 29 seconds and they did it in 31 seconds. But when it rained, these youngsters from Central and Lincoln High School, when the umpire dropped his hand, they had that tarp down in 45 seconds.
Wow.
Mel Allen used to take a stopwatch and time him how long it would take, 30, 45 seconds. When they always put the tarp down, Finley would say, double their salary and take them down to Brian's Barbecue. And if there's any kids hanging down there, take them in with you and feed them and then tell Arthur to send the bill. And then we had a picnic area. And then every time the press would come in for the visiting press and the local press for the first day when they came in, he'd have a barbecue for them in that picnic area. And soon that barbecue was over with. He had those kids from Lincoln and Central High School for a barbecue every time the press had one. And then when school came, he'd give them $100 and say, go buy school clothes and school supplies. But the catch to that was that they had to bring the things they bought to Charlie to see that they spent that money on school clothes and school supplies. But it was, he didn't lose the common touch, I would say. And people hate me to this day that I love Charlie Finley, because when Charlie moved, he wanted me to go with him, but I went out there and helped him on things, and I wouldn't take a penny, but my wife and my children be loaded with gifts. And it was one of those things that like Mayor Roar Bartle and Ernie Mel, Jack Stedman, enticed me to stay here and they would help me.
Yeah.
But they never did help me because I never thought got the assistant or extra money or anything like that. But sometimes I love those people, not ripping me in any manner, but sometimes maybe they kept me here just to say that I love Charlie O'Finley. Pay me back, you know, it's something to think about. But the most important thing, I think I believe in the Lord, and the Lord has helped me. And I, to this day, I pray every night to thank the Lord for the people that helped me throughout the career, especially the high school kids and groundkeepers that helped me all the way through my career.
You know, last year with when the Chiefs won the AFC championship against the Titans, I was far more emotional watching Clark Hunt hoist the Lamar Hunt trophy than I was hoisting the Vince Lombardi trophy because it had his dad's name on it. And just talk about the impact that the Hunt family had on you.
Well, the Hunt family, the first thing I would say is at the Super Bowl, they treated me as if I was one of their sons at the Super Bowl last year. I mean, Clark Hunt did anything and everything he could for me at the Super Bowl last year, along with Norma Hunt, because I was pulling for Lamar Hunt.
Yeah.
And I was one of the first people probably to see Lamar Hunt in Kansas City. I worked by myself, like I said, I never had an assistant or anything like that. And I was on top of the center field shed roof. And we had the flagpole that came up through the roof with a hole in it to put the flag up every day. So it was October, so it was time to take a piece of plyboard and cover that hole up to keep the snow from coming into the shed. And I looked to my right, and there in left field was a man about 9 o'clock in the morning walking across the grass. So I slid down that pole, went over it all, and told this man to kindly leave. You're not supposed to be in here, bing, bing, bing. So he never said a word to me. And kind went out. About 2 hours later, a Cadillac pulls up, and here comes Roy Bartle. He says, George, come over here. Went over there. He says, I have two gentlemen here. I like you to show them the stadium, the clubhouses, the offices, the concession stand. Give them a tour. And the first guy came out was a big 6'6" guy, built. And he said, this is Mr. Jack. And then the other guy came out was the guy that I told him he had to hit the road. He said, this is Mr. Lamar. And then a couple of weeks later, I find out that Mr. Jack is Jack Stedman, and Mr. Hunt, Mr. Lamar is Mr. Lamar Hunt. And then Lamar and I hit it pretty close. And then, like for every game in the morning, Sunday, Lamar Hunt, and he had a friend, Bill McNutt, would come and we walk the field and see how it is, anything we got to do. And people don't know, I was the first one to say that we need flags on the goalpost. And people don't know that Lamar Hunt was the first one to recommend arrows by the numbers. So we worked together, and then we went to the Super Bowl. So at the Super Bowl, I came back one night, and Lamar says, George, can you come out with me, take a ride with me to the airport? I'd like to pick my wife up and some friends. So I take a shower, I'll be right down. So we went to get a car, his car, and it's missing. Here, Hank Stram stole it, took it. So we had, that's Hank.
Yeah.
And then we had to get another car, and we went out, and that's when we picked up Norma and everybody. And then during that week, Lamar Hunt and Bill McNutt says, we helped you get to the Super Bowl. We're your agents now. You have to pay us $1 a year each. And Bill McNutt says, you know, Bill McNutt owned a big bakery in Corsicana, Texas. And he says, I may send you a fruitcake, you know, around Christmas. So that went on, and I received my 54th fruitcake. And so I sent, Lamar died and Bill died. So I sent the $2 to Bill's son, Bob McNutt. But we had that close relationship. Yeah. But at the Super Bowl last year, I can't say enough about Clark Hunt and Norma Hunt and the Lamar Hunt Jr., who I was one of their family. I never been treated so well in one day like they treated me the day of the Super Bowl.
That's really cool, George. And I appreciate you sharing that. You talked a little bit. Just tell me a little bit about your time in the service, and then I want to reference that as we go to what we talked about or how we spent some time together this past October. So tell us a little bit about your military background.
Well, actually, in my military, I was in 1950, and in that year, Emil Bosser and I went down to Florida to Daytona Beach. Like in 1948, we went to Suffolk, Virginia at a Naval Air Station deactivated to build some baseball fields for spring training. Then we went to Alabama at an Air Force base. And in 1950, we went to Naval Air Base in Daytona Beach, and we built 6 fields there. And today, that's where the Daytona 500 is. So then I came back and visited AMO, and I was drafted into the Army for 2 years. So I went to Fort Knox, and then went to Fort Sill, and then went to Camp Chaffee to leadership school. And then I went to Korea, and I was a sergeant first class in the 7th, 2nd Infantry Division, fought in Korea. Then when I came back home, I started my baseball career again. But serving the country was something, and I learned a lot. And it's, you don't know what freedom is, and we have freedom, so on. Glad that I helped our country in some way.
And in a sense, you're still helping the country. I'm going to reference that because you and I reconnected in an event in October here in Kansas City called Wiffle at the Hollow. And it was a fundraising event to raise funds for an organization called The Battle Within that helps military veterans and first responders deal with the effects of PTSD. And it's a fundraising wiffle ball tournament. And a couple of years ago, you were asked to be ceremonial groundskeeper. And I'm not sure what ceremonial means to most people, but to you, it means pick up a shovel and a rake and get to work. I'm told that they expected you to show up at the day of the event and hold a shovel or hold a rake and have people recognize you. And you spent weeks getting that field ready, and you did it again this year. And talk about just the fact that you just don't slow down. And then I'll ask you about the Battle Within project as well.
Well, actually, when they asked me to do that, Mitch Wheeler came and asked me to do it. And I was glad to do so, and would give me something to do. And at that time, Joe Undershick, I mean, out there does a terrific job. It's his property. And the children in the neighborhood use it. And they were anywhere from 8 to 12 years old. And a year ago, they helped me rebuild that little field. A 10-year-old girl painted the lines. And Marty Seiler from Epic Landscaping, I mean, what a man he was. help. You couldn't find better people than him. And this year with Mari Seiler and Eptic, and every day he would send a man to help me. And he was there every day. Mm-hmm. And every day was a different man. But these men were so dedicated and hardworking from Eptic that I would have to say they were in the top three companies in my 79 years in this game that were so dedicated and worked very hard, like these people from Eptic and the kids in the neighborhood and Marty. And I can't say enough about them. May God bless them.
And just talk a little bit about the program, The Battle Within. When you and I sat at the stadium, it's a guy's front yard, but sat there and talked about it. You talked about how important it was for you to give back to the veterans and to the first responders by helping them, you know, helping the battle within help them with the effects of PTSD. Just talk about that the meaning of that for you.
Well, actually, it was great for me to get being in the service and working with all these people. And I was working and taking a break and sitting on the bench by the third base. And a man came up to me and he came to thank me for what I'm doing. And he says it wasn't for the program. Hmm. He wouldn't be here today. He would have committed suicide.
Wow.
And then I had my youngest son, Ryan, who's an airline pilot for Delta, but was furloughed. He'd help me. And he's 37 years old. And this will be his 38th Super Bowl. But Phyllis George, the young Miss America, walked him around the field when he was 6 months old. But we had so many people to help us to get that. And then my middle son, Rick, who's a COO of a financial company in New Jersey. And when he was born, Charlie O'Finley gave him $2,000 in those days for college education. And he graduated from William & Mary, and he came out for the ceremony.
Wow.
And a week ago, he was a lieutenant in Desert Storm. Hmm. He was the tank commander in Desert Storm. And one of his close friends, an officer, had this problem after the war.
Sure.
And I was very glad to find out that my son's, Rick's company, donated $10,500 2 weeks ago to this great cause to help these veterans, because he's seen it.
Yeah.
And to help all the veterans. And I can't say enough about all the people involved with this, of what they do. And each one of them have the end in some. And I say, may God bless them.
One of the stories that I heard while I was there for the event, Mari Seiler, who you talked about, came up to me and was just marveling at your ability to still do what you do. And he said that, you know, he's the president or CEO of the landscaping company. And he said he came over and gave one of his guys a shovel or a rake or something. And one of the guys that works for him, and that you looked at him and said, Marty, do you play golf? And he said, yeah. And he said, I'll bet you use a caddy.
Yeah, but Marty is good, because I said I knew his father.
Yeah.
And his father was great. And I always tell Marty every time I see him, I say, you know, Marty, I knew your dad. We got along good. He's up in heaven and he's smiling at you now for what a great job you're doing, not only for Eptic, but for this entire operation at the Hollow. And you couldn't find better people than Marty and the people that work for Marty. Like I said, in my 79 years in the game, they're in the top three that people I worked with around the world.
All right. I'm going to wrap up with this. I know a lot of people who are younger than you who have trouble getting around their own homes, and yet you're constantly on your hands and knees paying attention to the finest details of a field. So a simple question with a probably a very complex answer. How do you stay so young?
Well, actually, I think I stay by working, and I think I stay by working with these young boys that I always worked with. You know, I was old enough to be their grandfather, and same way at the Super Bowl, you know, we're one big family. We have some, maybe we'll be there a year, and some like Eddie Mangan, our director of the fields. Well, I got the job at Atlanta Braves and got him the job 15 years ago as director of fields with the league. And people like that do the job. And like I say, again, there's no George Toma without Charlie Finley, the boys from Central and High School and the boys I worked with. And even later on, I would have to say maybe the boys from Raytown High School in that area. But a lot of them have helped me. And today, there's a lot of them are doctors, they're lawyers, they have their own landscape businesses, are doing very well. And Trevor's the head groundkeeper for the Chiefs and for the Royals, who I helped get the job. And young people, like they have a boy at Doug Schallenberger, a groundkeeper at the Chiefs. He'd been there for 35 years. Wow. When he was a young student, just out of high school, I would send him to Japan to do work in Japan to get ready for NFL games in Japan. When Roger Goodell was just young yet, and he would run a playoff game, like the playoffs coming in, I would send Doug Schallenberger to work with Roger Goodell, and did a tremendous job. And so all these people, like I say, first of all, the Lord has helped me. And I pray to the Lord every night for thanking him for sending these people to help me, because they made me. And without them, there would be no George Toma.
All right. Last question, I promise. How long have you had that shirt? I just love that shirt. That looks like it's maybe from the 60s or 70s. How long have you had it?
No, actually, this shirt here would have been probably about 35 years old right now, because I last year with the Chiefs it was in 1989, and my son took my place, and then later on he became the head groundkeeper for the NFL, like director feels like Eddie Mangan is. And I can't thank Chip enough, and he went worldwide on fields, and he became close with Pele and did some work for Pele, and so Eddie, I have been Super Bowl Eddie Mangan, and Chip did a lot for me, but I can't thank enough the people around the world that helped me, and people here in Kansas City. I had so many good offers to go to work money-wise, and I took a loss. I hate to say that I lost money in Kansas City working, but it wasn't for the league to even things out. I did it. But like my wife says, there's not enough money in the world to pay me for something that I love doing. And so I just love doing what I'm doing, and for the people that help me and the family, and most of all, I believe in the Lord, and I still thank him every night for sending these people that help me.
Well, my friend, you are a Kansas City treasure. We are fortunate that you are a part of our history, our sports history, and I thank you very much for joining us.
Well, I'll say thanks for having me. And this old man loves you, you're a young man. and to you and all your followers. And one reason I talked to you at the Wiffle Ball Hollow, and I know that you're a great man and you haven't lost the common touch. And that's what I love you for, is not lost the common touch. Wow. And to you and to all your followers and all the fans and all the people that have helped me, may all your good fortunes during the coming year and the years to come be as numerous as blades of grass and then some.
All right. Great way to wrap up. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smale. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smale and his work by visiting davidsmalebooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.